The Court of Appeals of the State of Nevada is now in session. The Honorable Chief Judge Gibbons presiding.
Okay, be seated, everyone. Good morning. Welcome to University of Nevada, Las Vegas, William S. Boyd School of Law. This is a special event today with us having oral argument here. It's actually become an annual event, and we like to allow the students to see a court in action, and this is a great courtroom. I know it's a conflict with classes a lot of times, and people can't make it, or they might only appear for part of it, but it's nice to have some students here. I'm joined today by Judge Bonnie Bulla to my left, Judge Deborah Westbrook to my right, and we have a number of our staff members here also. We're going to introduce some of them individually. We have our, as you just heard, our new chief clerk for our court, Shannon Westfall. Shannon's been with the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court since 2014, and previously clerked for Chief Justice James Hardesty. And we also have our security here today. It's a big issue in everybody's mind with Marshals Don and Ding. And in the back, Kurt Jensen, who's now the division director for the Court of Appeals, and Marshall Hedrick next to Kurt, who works for both the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court in an administrative capacity, and is a regular visitor over here at Boyd also. We have some of our individual chambers members, many of whom are former Boyd students. So it's to the front for my chambers, Brendan Brandale, May 2022 Boyd graduate, and Molly Marius, May 2023 Boyd graduate. And Judge Bulla, would you like to introduce your staff?
Certainly. Good morning.
Welcome, everyone.
Good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here. We know that the school has been through a lot, and we are honored to participate today before you all. Know that we are always with you, and we are very supportive of the school and of the dean, of the professors and the students. And we credit you with being here today and observing what we hope will be very interesting oral argument. No pressure, counsel. I would like to introduce my staff briefly, all Boyd grads. My chamber's counsel is Sahara Nawabazada. Next to her is Nick Wolfram and Valerie Cushell, both Boyd grads. And again, we're just very pleased to be here today. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Deborah Westbrook, new on the court for about a year, and my staff, I have Kelsey Bernstein, who's a class of 2015 grad from Boyd. I have Keith Katola from Michigan. They beat UW, so, but I'm okay. We're still on speaking terms. And then I have Alyssa Williams in the front row, who just graduated from Boyd last year. I also have some externs, actually, I think only one of them is here right now, Kelsey Henderson. I also have Kayla Hall, who is externing for me, and I met both of them during the client counseling competition. So I just encourage you guys to get involved in activities. Oh, there she is. Hey, you could have sat up with everybody, just to let you know. You get extra special treatment. Anyway, get involved because, you know, I wouldn't have met them had I not judged, and they were both fabulous as witnesses in client counseling. We also have, from my Huelas mentorship group, Michael Pappas, who's going to be clerking for Chief Judge Gibbons next year. Mm-hmm. Yes, and Vanessa Aponte, where did I see you? Hey, so she's also in Huelas, so if you guys want to get involved in the Huelas mentorship groups, to bring students along and in the pipeline to increase diversity in our profession. It's a wonderful organization to get involved with. Let's see, who else do we have? I've got, next year, I've got Jay Bruner clerking, who graduated last year. So we are very, very supportive of Boyd. There's a lot of talent here at this university, and we're just very, very happy to be here.
I see some other future law clerks here, too. One of mine, Eric Lundy. And yours?
I have Charles Kalaney and Catherine Hayes. And very excited to have you all join us. I also want to give out a nice little shout to our IT people who are here,
yes,
who made this all possible.
Way back.
Thanks, everyone.
Okay, Judge Westbrook, you also have some people that you were close colleagues with,
yes,
at one point in time.
Yes, well, I mean, and Chief, you'll be obviously introducing them both, but Alex Chen, who is the current team chief for the Clark County District Attorney's Office, and Steve Owens, who's the former team chief for the appellate team for the Clark County District Attorney's Office. So what's great is you guys get to see a combat of legal appellate titans today. I'm actually super excited to watch both of them. So it's fun. It's fun to have them here.
Okay. And in case any of you didn't know, maybe the couple, two or three people, Judge Westbrook was the chief deputy in the Clark County.
Not chief.
chief appellate deputy.
A chief.
A chief. A
chief. We're all chiefs when we hit like a certain, like 5 years. But anyway.
So, the appellate deputy that did a lot of cases with the gentlemen that are here now,
yes,
arguing today on the first case.
That's right.
So. Time moves on.
Anyway.
Well, on that happy note.
Well, we have two very interesting cases today and, of course, very important cases. The first one that we will hear is Chadwick versus State, and the second one is Judd versus State. We are not going to take any recess between the two cases. However, when we are done with the two cases, we are willing to take questions from any students or other people in the audience, and if counsel's able to remain for that time period, we found that it's very helpful for them. They often have questions about a career path. Everybody's interested in their first job and their second job, so understanding how you got to where you were, and many people want to go to the district attorney's office too. So if you can possibly stay, please do. And then also with the counsel on the second case. So we have Mr. Chen here representing the state and Mr. Owens representing the appellant. And so the normal procedure is 15 minutes of oral argument for each side, and the appellant can reserve time for rebuttal if requested. Do you want to do that, Mr. Owens? Right, so we've gotten through our preliminary introductions. You're not used to this long pre-argument presentation, but thank you for bearing with us. And I still remember my first argument, that was oral argument, when I was in the district attorney's office and I did my own cases, did my own appeals. My first argument away from the Supreme Court in Carson City was at the Pioneer Auditorium on Virginia Street in downtown Reno. And they had a bunch of high schools in there watching that argument. So that was pretty intense for that. I can't remember what the case was now, but I certainly remember the audience. All right, so hopefully you'll appreciate this opportunity to set an example for some of the students. All right, Mr. Owens, you can proceed.
May it please the court, I'm Steve Owens on behalf of the appellant in this matter, Joey Chadwick. Mr. Chadwick was convicted of one count of leaving the scene of an accident involving personal injury following a three-day jury trial. He was acquitted of an associated reckless driving charge. Factually, what happened was very tragic. On a Halloween night in 2021, a young girl was out celebrating, doing Halloween activities with her family after dark and stepped out into the road directly in front of my client's van as he was traveling down the street. And tragically, she was hit. She sustains injuries that could have been much worse. Miraculously, she survived and is certainly scarred, but it could have been much worse than what it was. By all accounts, the accident could not have been avoided. She was so small, so short, and jumped out so quickly in front of the van that that it just couldn't be avoided. The police cleared my client of any fault for causing the accident. Yet he did not stay at the scene, and that's what causes us to be here. In this jury trial, what should have been the only issue for the jury to really focus on and to decide was whether, when he left the scene, he knew or should have known that he was involved in an accident and had hit this child, or whether, according to his testimony, he thought it was simply a speed bump or a pothole, and the van rattled all the time like that, and when he heard the noise, he looked behind and did not see anything in the street, and so continued on. But that's what the jury should have focused on. Unfortunately, in this case, the state saw fit to introduce some extraneous facts that greatly prejudiced my client and distracted the jury from that important issue. First and foremost, they brought in this issue of intoxication. They claimed that my client was heavily inebriated, was drunk. They did this properly through a pretrial motion, and there was a hearing where the judge ruled that it would be admissible, but I think it was improperly granted that motion.
So, Mr. Owens, why wouldn't evidence that your client consumed alcoholic beverages immediately prior to the accident and appeared to be drunk driving, why wouldn't that be relevant to establish his motive to flee the scene, where motive is a relevant non-propensity purpose?
Well, he didn't appear to be drunk driving. He was acquitted of reckless driving, weaving, speeding, any kind of crazy movement with the car. The jury acquitted him of that. There was one passenger in the vehicle that alleged that he had been drinking before the accident. The judge said it was relevant to show motive for leaving the scene. But here, my client admitted, when he saw it on the news a day later and there was talk in the neighborhood, he put two and two together and realized that was me in my van. That wasn't a pothole. Oh, my gosh, I had a child. He went and turned himself in.
But why wouldn't that go to his motive, knowing that he had been consuming as much alcohol as he had and his passenger had seen him consuming that alcohol? Why wouldn't he worry that if he had stayed, he might be arrested for DUI with substantial bodily harm?
Well, that carries no greater penalty than what he was convicted of.
Why would he know that?
Well, why would he not know that? He's hit a child on Halloween night. I don't know why people leave knowing that. He says he didn't know that, but people don't want to stay around and face that. They're shocked. They're startled. There's a responsibility. He doesn't know that he's going to be cleared of any wrongdoing for the accident. He may find that he's charged with being responsible with it. There was a lot of people out in the street, parents and other children.
So you don't think there's any relevance at all to his motive for fleeing the scene? You don't think it goes to his motive at all?
The fact that he hit a child at night on Halloween with all her family around in a bad part of town, I think that's motive enough for someone to leave the scene. Not that that's right, but adding intoxication in doesn't make it any more likely that he left the scene. He admitted that he did not stay at the scene. That simply was not an issue.
But knowledge was an issue, whether he knew he hit somebody.
Yes, that's definitely an issue.
So given that he placed his knowledge in issue, why isn't his motive for leaving relevant to the knowledge?
Well, why does intoxication make it more or less likely that he knew or should have known that he hit a child? They simply wanted to paint him up as being some bad driver. Well, that's not what caused the accident. They wanted to dirty him up, inhibit his character already in front of the jury. I don't see how it makes knowledge any more likely that he knew that he had hit a child simply because he may have had some alcohol.
Let's talk about prejudice. He was acquitted, as you point out, of the reckless driving. How was this evidence then prejudicial if the jury acquitted him of reckless driving?
Well, now he took the stand because in addition to motive, the judge also admitted intoxication to show for impeachment purposes, preemptive impeachment. I've never heard of such a thing. He was now incumbent on him to actually take the stand and defend himself, not just against the knowledge of whether he knew he'd hit someone, but also against this allegation that he had been drinking. He denied that he had been drinking. And so now he's prejudiced. Now he's not just someone who on Halloween ran over a child, but he's somebody who did so intoxicated.
Did the state actually impeach him when he testified by asking him about the contrary statement made by Helen Henry?
I believe they've shifted their argument on appeal, and they're claiming now that it was intoxication is relevant to competency as a witness, his ability to perceive. And I agree that in certain situations that can be an issue. That's not why it was admitted.
Well, I'm actually asking at trial, was he actually impeached during his testimony with Helen's statement?
Well, impeached, he disagreed with Helen's statement, yes. I don't know if he was impeached with it. You'd be impeached with your own statement. He was challenged with the allegations that Helen Henry had made, and he denied them. But it's not like it was used for impeachment of some prior inconsistent statement of his own. And it was not used in a way to challenge his ability to perceive that night. They could have, but they didn't. And there was no limiting instruction here. We don't know what the jury did with intoxication.
Now, counsel, though, you did not raise on appeal the failure to give a limiting instruction with respect to the drunk driving and intoxication, correct?
I did not. I did ask to the gang affiliation issue, but I did not hear. But it's still relevant to show prejudice. You asked me about prejudice. Well, he's prejudiced because we don't know how the jury used that information. They weren't limited as to how they were going
to
use it.
But that's not an argument you made in your brief. You would concede, correct?
Well, I've argued prejudice. And you've asked me about prejudice, and I'm saying that's how we get the prejudice. Why is he prejudiced by this intoxication coming in? We don't know how the jury used it.
Well, I mean, Mr. Owen,
yes.
Let me ask this question. Let's just put the facts aside for a minute and just talk about the rules of evidence. Motive clearly is a non-propensity reason for evidence to be allowed in. So if the evidence went to motive, that could be used for non-propensity purposes, right?
Sure. Motive's one of the reasons other bad acts can come in.
So with regard to the intoxication, the motive issue would be he didn't stay around because he was concerned about that. I'm not saying that this is what happened. I'm just saying that could go to motive, right?
It could, but the nature of the charge, motive, when you're talking about leaving the scene, it does not make sense to me. The issue is knowledge, knew or should have known, not the fact of leaving
the
scene.
That's the substantive charge, correct. I agree with you on that. But in terms of just non-propensity evidence, motive is critical here. So how did the judge abuse discretion by allowing the intoxication in as part of motive?
Well, again, it's not disputed that he left the scene.
Right.
And when an issue is not disputed, it minimizes the probative value, and it's outweighed substantially by that danger of the unfair prejudice of hearing that, oh, not only did he run over a child, but he was drunk at the time. Also, I don't think it was proven up by clear and convincing evidence. This was an unreliable witness who had been drinking herself, had contradicted herself many times, and kept adding new facts in all the way up to trial that she was impeached with. So,
wouldn't that cut against your argument, given that your or the trial attorney in this case actually spent a significant amount of time questioning Helen Henry about the intoxication? I mean, didn't your client essentially put that evidence repeatedly in front of the jury on cross-examination?
Through cross-examination, well, I mean, it came in because of the bad acts motion filed by the state. What else is a defense attorney supposed to do? He's got to fight as best he can. And he would be ineffective if he didn't try to cross-examine, and now that that's the state of the evidence. So that doesn't mean he's consenting to the intoxication coming in. And how about the, I'm mindful of time, gang affiliation.
But one more question on the motive issue. So you said that he left the scene. There's no dispute about him leaving the scene.
Yes.
What's the scene that he left when his statement was that he hit a pothole? There's no crime scene. What did he leave?
Well, he left the area where he subsequently learned there had been an accident.
There's no crime. Nothing happened.
Which is why he kept going.
The question is, would he have known that he hit a person?
Right.
So how does the state prove that he hit a person when he said he thought he hit a pothole?
Well, it comes down to credibility. Let the jury fairly judge the reliability of his testimony versus that of the passenger in the car who said, I told him he hit a girl. And so they can judge the credibility of that. They can look at all the other testimony.
And you said he wasn't at fault. It was unavoidable. So no crime was committed. So why not just stay at the scene? The reason to leave the scene is there was a separate crime of the drinking and the driving, potentially. That's why a person leaves the scene.
Well, they may leave for any number of reasons, and I don't think all those reasons get to come in on a case like this where the only issue is knowledge. And we may disagree on that, but I don't see it being relevant to motive. The motive to leave is really irrelevant. It's leaving with knowledge that you hit somebody. If you had knowledge, even if you were intoxicated, even if you had cocaine in the car, none of that matters. If you knew that you hit somebody, that's the only element that we're here for. That's the motive for leaving, is to avoid any responsibility, civil responsibility. The shock of hitting a child, you don't know, you don't process as a driver in your head, I imagine, all the legal consequences, or no one would leave the scene. But in the panic, they leave. And I don't think we can just go grab every other crime that might have been committed out there and say, well, they had lots of reasons to leave.
It's a pretty heavy burden on the state to prove that he had knowledge that he hit a person and it wasn't just some bump in the road. All right, you were going to move on to the issue of the gang affiliation?
Gang affiliation, yes. Again, now we're dirtying up the defendant again, my client, with not just that he was a drunk driver who ran over this poor Halloween child, but now he's a gang member. That came in through the open door doctrine. There's some dispute in the briefs as to whether or not it was preserved. I think it was preserved because the judge ruled on it and said, hey, if you go into the gang affiliation of this witness, then I'm going to let the state get into the gang affiliation of the defendant. I don't think those two are the same. I think that was a misapplication of the open door doctrine.
Well, Mr. Owens, why wasn't a Tavares instruction asked for then? Why didn't you ask for one?
Well, there was no motion. This just came up all of a sudden. I think everyone was caught off guard when suddenly the judge is ruling that, oh, you opened the door to it, it's coming in. Ideally, it would have been nice if somebody in that courtroom had thought about a Tavares instruction to limit the purpose for which this gang affiliation was admitted, which supposedly was once again for motive. So this is the problem with motive, with the charge of leaving the scene of an accident, is you can say anything negative about the defendant and say that's why he left. I'm out of time, and I want to reserve the rest for later. Thank you.
All right, you have 2 minutes reserved. Thank you. All right, Mr. Chen, go ahead.
Good morning. May it please the court. Alexander Chen on behalf of the respondent, State of Nevada. So in this particular case, Chief Justice Gibbons, you said that the state does have a high burden, and we have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt of this accident and then that someone left it. But in most cases, or in many cases, you can't guarantee that there's going to be someone else in the car. In this particular case, what we have to rely on in terms of not only the accident itself, but the fact that the defendant fled the scene and knowingly fled the scene after an accident, was the testimony of Helen Henry. Now, I understand that in much of Appellant's brief, they criticize Ms. Henry's testimony and they talk about how unreliable it was. But as this court has always held, that is completely for the jury to determine. And not only that, Ms. Henry testified, and it was contrasted with the defendant's own testimony. So in this particular case, the defendant chose to take the stand. He gave his version of events. He contradicted much of what Ms. Henry said, and the jury was able to weigh that and ultimately decided that it was appropriate to find that she had told that defendant that...
Well, Mr. Chen, it's not very often you have an eyewitness that's sitting in the car and saw exactly what happened and can describe it and actually was the person that brought it to light, that Mr. Chadwick was the driver. So was there really an issue about her credibility? I mean, it's Mr. Owens is saying, well, they didn't need it. They're just piling on with this extra evidence of drinking and intoxication. Just bring in the witness. Don't muck up the record with this other information. But at the same time, he says, well, she wasn't credible. So which way was it? I mean, was she a credible witness or not?
It was for the jury to determine, which they determined she was credible. And the main part about the alcohol was that she was simply saying she told him to stop. Stop the car, you just hit this girl. And he said, calm down. He attacked her for being drunk. He said, I'm not going to stop. I didn't hit anything. I didn't do anything. So she tried to tell him to stop. It was his decision that he was going to keep driving, despite her warning. And then that gets into, well, why did he not stop at the scene? And that's where we brought in evidence of the drinking, in which she said he was drinking. They brought in motives of other things. And kind of to piggyback along with the gang information that Mr. Owens was just talking about, this was a neighborhood, and evidence came out where it was a low socioeconomic neighborhood. There were gang ties to the neighborhood, not necessarily the defendant himself, but just the neighborhood in general, and there was a reluctance to call the police in general. The victims themselves, and the victim's mom herself, who testified at trial, talked about the fact that there was a reluctance to get the police involved because there was a general mistrust of police officers. So any of those things could be the reason why the individual chose not to stop, and that's why all this evidence needed to come in, because it was painting an entire picture of what happened and why did people react the way that they did. And ultimately, defendant chose not to stop at the scene because he didn't want to be in trouble, whether it was his distrust, whether it was because he was drinking, or whether because he just didn't feel like stopping at that particular point because he just didn't want to. All of that evidence came out at trial, and it was for the jury to determine that those were the facts.
Mr. Chen,
one quick follow-up, and I'll move on. Mr. Owens contended that this was an unavoidable accident, that Mr. Chadwick was cleared about causing the accident, and he's referring to the reckless driving charge. Reckless driving requires willful or wanton conduct. In other words, a person's aware of a dangerous situation and they proceed in the face of it. So did the state argue below that the fact that he was drinking, allegedly Mr. Chadwick, that that was actual evidence of the crime for reckless driving and not just a bad act under the leaving the scene?
No, I don't believe that the state argued that drinking was part of his reckless driving. What the state relied upon, and obviously the jury again found that there wasn't enough evidence to prove reckless driving, was the fact that there was testimony about whether he had sped off. There was testimony about how he was driving with the kids in the area. And ultimately, the jury just didn't find that there was enough evidence for that. But it wasn't an argument that this individual...
The reckless driving charge, the felony reckless, has a proximate cause element too, that the driving was the cause of the accident, and also a substantial bodily harm element that doesn't exist just for the misdemeanor charge. Right. Same thing for felony DUI. Right. So I was asking the question, if he'd just stopped at the scene, would everything have been okay because it was an unavoidable accident? And if he wasn't drinking, then there was no crime to even investigate.
And I would agree with you there, Chief Judge Gibbons, that if that was the case, he simply could have stopped. But certainly there was reasons why he chose not to stop that particular day. I do think that there was evidence, and the reason that the state was able to bring a charge, and again, probable cause at the preliminary hearing was different from proving it beyond a reasonable doubt at trial, but there was some evidence about the manner in which he was driving. And again, I understand that the jury found that there wasn't enough evidence to convict him of that.
So, Mr. Chen, I have a few questions, and it's going to transition to the gang affiliation and threat issue.
Yes.
So, first of all, when the court initially ruled that the gang affiliation could come in if he asked Helen Henry about her gang affiliation, the purpose of that was to establish that he had the same motive for leaving the scene as she allegedly did, correct? It was a, yes. It was a rival gang. The accident occurred in that neighborhood, and they did not want the rival gang to come after them,
yes.
Essentially. So would you agree that when the state actually ended up questioning Helen Henry about the gang affiliation, it was for a different purpose? The state ended up tying the threat that was allegedly made to the gang affiliation and essentially using or suggesting that because they were both members of a gang, this threat carried more weight.
I think that's a fair characterization. Again, that goes to kind of understanding the entire neighborhood and the players that were involved in terms of why they all acted the way they did.
Under that circumstance, would it be fair to say that the state went beyond what the district court said it could do with that evidence when it ruled that the door was open?
I don't believe so, Judge Westbrook. I think that ultimately, when defense counsel chose to ask her about the gang affiliation, which hadn't been raised by any party up until that point, he was doing so, again, attacking her motive for why she would go talk to the family. Because remember, what Helen Henry did was the very next day or 2 days later, I can't quite remember, she goes directly to the victim's family and explains what happened. Right. And again, that what defense tried to paint it as was she was trying to be, she was worried about retaliation against her. But I have to ask this question, why would she be worried about retaliation if nothing happened? The reason that she was worried was because this individual she was in the van with hit somebody and left the scene. That's the reason that she does the things that she does. So I think that ultimately, even if anything went beyond what the court allowed it for, anything there would be harmless, because I do think that everything was there just to explain why things happened the way they did.
Okay, but go ahead.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about the threat specifically. Now, that actually came out initially when the defense was cross-examining Helen Henry, correct? Like, the question was, why didn't you tell anybody? And then in response to a open-ended question that maybe wasn't the best question counsel could have asked, she then says, well, he threatened me. So, I mean, wouldn't that essentially be eliciting the bad, the defense counsel elicited the bad act, correct?
I mean, again, I think it was trying to explain the situation, but yes.
So do you believe that the court has a duty to sua sponte, issue a Tavares instruction, when it is the defense that puts the bad act, that first puts the bad act out in front of the jury?
I don't think so. Generally speaking, it's the state, I guess, who's trying to introduce these bad acts, and then they can determine whether they want the Tavares instruction or not. But I don't think there was a duty for the court, especially with how the evidence came out here, that a Tavares instruction would be necessary.
I mean, can we perhaps limit Tavares to the facts of, where it's, doesn't Tavares really deal with when the state is putting bad acts into evidence?
That's how I interpret it, yes.
Okay. Mr. Chin, I want to go back to the gang affiliation issue for a minute. Once the defense raised the issue that it wanted to examine the percipient witness, the witness in the van, Ms. Henry, about, why she would have felt threatened and her gang affiliation, that has nothing to do with his potential gang affiliation. There was discussion on the record, though, that it could potentially result in questions. Why at that minute didn't the state ask for a Petrocelli hearing? Why wasn't there some discussion of a Tavares instruction? Why wouldn't that happen?
Well, if I'm not mistaken, I think when the Petrocelli hearing happened initially, the court heard testimony about the drinking, and the court heard testimony about potential other drugs that were illicit drug use, and I believe that the other thing that the court heard about was kind of related to this gang affiliation.
You think they had a Petrocelli hearing on the gang affiliation?
Well, they determined it, and the court kind of said, well, I'm not going to let you get it in for these other purposes as we go right now, and there was some discussion about what was going to come out at trial, but the problem is no one really knew what was going to happen at trial because certainly we had the evidence that we intended to put forth, but my point is we didn't know the defendant was going to testify, so a lot of this stuff is done in an abundance of caution, that you have the bad act motion in case something's going to happen at the actual trial.
But wasn't there an expectation that the gang affiliation probably would be discussed in relation to the defendant, too?
Yes, and I think that came out. One of the things that Ms. Henry said, and I believe it was in her early testimony, was, questions were asked, why didn't you stop the car? Why didn't you do what you did? And her answer was, I was scared of him. He was drinking. I was scared of him. There was this gang relation. So all of that went to the reasons that she didn't do the things that she needed to do or that were expected of her. And the jury was asking her questions about it as well. Why didn't you stop the car? Why didn't you get out of the car and call someone? And her response was, I think she said the doors were locked, and she also said, I wasn't driving the car, so I couldn't stop the car. And then she said she was afraid of the defendant.
Thank you.
So ultimately, and I can gather from how some of the questions have been posed, did everything happen perfectly? Perhaps everything didn't happen perfectly. Rarely in trials do they. But I would say that to the extent that these issues, such as the gang affiliation or the alcohol, were discussed, they were used for the very limited purposes that we've discussed here today. They were used for the limited purposes of trying to explain the entire situation, whether it's res geste or whether you want to consider it motive under a bad acts analysis. That was the purpose of them. At no point did the state harp on the fact that this is a bad person because they drink, or this is a bad person because they're in a gang. It wasn't argued at all by the state or by either of the parties that that's what was going on here. It was only argued in the context of trying to provide analysis for why people responded the way that they did. And again, in looking at the case, it's not that everyone acted perfectly in this, including Ms. Henry. There's probably things she could have done. There's things that the families could have done, and there's a whole discussion about the responsibilities of the people involved. But ultimately, the jury was able to examine the evidence. And I do want to just say one other thing about the evidence that was presented is the defendant's whole version is that he's driving a large van and that the van has a lot of equipment in it, and the equipment is noisy and it's an old van. Now, while that might be true, I certainly don't think that that's meant to inure a benefit to him, that because you're driving a car that's old, because you're driving a car that has a lot of things in it, because it's a tall van, that somehow you have less of a responsibility to stop at an accident, or that you have less of a responsibility to do the things that the legislature has required you do if you're in an accident. And that's what he's trying to say is, well, how could I have known about what happened? But ultimately, in this case, we're fortunate enough that there was another person in the car. There was someone who could say, I saw the girl hit the car and I told him to stop. And ultimately, again, that's a jury question in which they determined that he certainly was responsible for leaving the scene. So I appreciate it. If there's no further questions, I'll submit it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chen. All right, we'll go back to the appellant, Mr. Chadwick, through Mr. Owens, 2 minutes.
Thank you. Again, we don't know how the jury used all this bad act evidence because there was no limiting instruction. The open door doctrine does not circumvent Petrocelli. Even if the defense in this case, and I wasn't trial counsel, I've been appointed for the appeal, but even if they had opened the door to this gang affiliation, that does not alleviate the state from having to pursue a Petrocelli hearing and prove up the three factors in order to get this in and get that limiting instruction. That simply wasn't done. And I would argue the open doors, it doesn't apply because it is not the same issue. The passenger's bias and motive for lying and making up stories and coming up with new threats that weren't in any prior testimony, and she blurts out in the middle of trial. Lots of new evidence came out in trial.
Well, you would agree, though, that your the predecessor, I guess the trial attorney, asked an open-ended question that, you know, on cross-examination of Helen Henry, to which Helen Henry responded, "He threatened me," correct? So your predecessor directly elicited that bad act.
I believe that's true, and if we have to deal with that in habeas, then we will. But I'm
my question, though, is under those circumstances, is there an obligation under Tavares for the district court to sua sponte instruct the jury when you were the party that introduced the bad act?
You've got to protect the record or we come back in habeas. The defense attorney's performance is important to the state, to the court, to the whole system.
Right, but my question is, under Tavares, under that decision, did the court have an independent duty to instruct when you introduced that evidence?
Frankly, I don't recall. I haven't read Tavares immediately before coming here, and I don't remember the exact holding in that scenario. But I think it makes sense that that Tavares should have been given, the instruction should have been given, or we're left in this position of not knowing how the jury used this. And they just let the damaging evidence stack up against my client to the point where we can no longer trust the jury's verdict that supposedly he knew or should have known he had a child. Thank you.
Hold on one
yes.
second.
Sorry, Judge Bola has one more question. It has to be shown that substantial and injurious effect or influence in determining the jury verdict was what resulted from this evidence. If you've indicated we can't tell the result, then how do we show it had an effect? Is it enough just to say we don't know and that's sufficient for a reversal? What are you asking us to do in that regard?
Well, I'm asking for a new trial and a new sentencing hearing. Either one would be an appropriate remedy here because they can't say that this trial rendered a verdict that we can trust, that we can rely upon. It affected the defendant's substantial rights to be tried on the charges and allegations that the state had alleged against him, not on him being a gang member, not on him being intoxicated, and let the jury do who knows what with those and hold it against him, undermine credibility of his testimony, which was really his only defense that he had.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Owens. Okay. This case will stand submitted then for a resolution by the court by written document. And I forgot to state the number, the case number. It's 86161 COA. So we hope to have a decision in the near future. Thank you very much, counsel. Excellent job on both.